is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Hafiz Khan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah. كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli warplanes pound parts of the besieged Gaza Strip, including a children's hospital there. US police say possible human remains have been found near the site of an explosion in the city of Nashville, an incident called an intentional act. Also ahead, a report by a British think tank says China will overtake the United States as the world's biggest economy by 2028. Good to have you with us. Our top story: Israeli warplanes have once again pounded the besieged Gaza Strip. A children's hospital in the Palestinian coastal enclave has also been hit. Earlier, our correspondent Ashraf Shana gave us more details on the attacks.
Israeli fighter jets attacked central Gaza and also the eastern part of Gaza City. During this airstrike, Israeli fighter jets damaged the children's hospital and also damaged a center that treats the disabled. At least one child was injured. Israeli fighter jets used at least 6 rockets against the Gaza Strip and also used artillery fire to attack areas in the east of Deir el-Balah. This has been a grim reminder to people of Gaza of the 2008 war. Around this time, 2008, Israel waged a 22-day war on Gaza, killing and maiming hundreds of people in the tiny enclave. Since then, Israel waged 2 more wars and caused huge destruction, a huge loss of life for nearly 2 million people in the Gaza Strip.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry has slammed Israel's latest attack on the country, saying such acts of aggression will not go without consequences. The remarks came in a letter sent to the United Nations Secretary General and the President of the UN Security Council in reaction to Israel's Friday airstrikes in Hama countryside. The letter stressed that continuous support from the US and some members of the Council has encouraged Israel to push ahead with its aggressive approach. Damascus condemned Israel's attacks as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council resolutions. It's also called on the Council to assume its responsibility in preventing Israeli attacks. Meanwhile, Russia criticized Israel's airstrikes on Syria, saying such actions, quote, further destabilize the complicated regional situation. political commentator Michael Springman says the United Nations remains silent despite Israel's continued aggression.
It's another outrage committed by the apartheid entity that calls itself Israel, and it's done only because the United States supports that illegitimate entity, and the United Nations, which in by and large is the creature of the United States, will take no action because it fears American pressure, it fears loss of money from the United States, and because the United States is a permanent member of the Security Council and can block any kind of resolution. It's unconscionable. The Israelis flew over Beirut and Lebanon, striking at Syria, claiming they were attacking, depending on which Israeli newspaper you read, the weapons production facility in Syria, or they were attacking Iran-supported military groups in the area. Christmas Eve attacks, of course, it's there are a number of Christians in Lebanon and in Syria, and it's a time for them of preparing for a great feast day, and they were scared out of their wits by the low-flying jets and the huge explosions.
The year 2020 has witnessed some of the most severe crises internationally over the past decades. In Lebanon, it was topped by a tragic explosion, which has been seen as one of the worst catastrophes, dramatically changing the political system of the country. Mariam Saleh has more in this report.
Since its independence in November 1948, Lebanon, the small Arab country, has been the scene of a myriad of conflicts, challenges, and political bickering. The year 2020 was not unlike any other year, but even more challenging. As the country was engulfed in the economic, financial, and monetary crisis, another challenge hit the global scene in the form of a novel coronavirus. The first few positive cases of COVID-19 in Lebanon forced the country, like the rest of the world, into a lockdown. This lockdown was preceded by an unseen monetary crisis where the Lebanese lira plummeted against the U.S. dollar. U.S. sanctions on Lebanon led banks to limit cash withdrawals, and queues were seen daily facing banks. Observers look at the year 2020 as being one of the darkest periods in Lebanon's history.
We've lost everything, literally. You know, we've lost the companies, we've lost the banks, we've lost the economical system, we've lost the political system. There's nothing left. And you know, when you have nothing left, the only thing left is humans and their potentials.
The overall system of governance in Lebanon is seen as something that needs to end. Waking up to a new crisis had become a norm until the Beirut port blast. A large amount of ammonium nitrate exploded. The explosion ripped through the port of Beirut, killing over 200 people and wounding over 6,500, destroying large parts of the city. With a multifaceted crisis in the Mediterranean country, the explosion in the Beirut port in August of 2020 only served as an additional, unprecedented blow and a national tragedy for all Lebanese. However, politicians and the media remained intensely at odds.
We're used to, you know, Israeli attacks. We're used to having a little bit of, you know, security incidents on the ground, but we have never been used to something so huge. As huge as it is, I guess it was great for uniting the Lebanese over, you know, a cause. This time and during the blast, we didn't find part of the Lebanese being happy for, you know, blasting another part of Lebanon. It was like, you know, general for all sects, for all people. And I guess it was a turning point because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that at this point we really need to rethink the political system in Lebanon. It was the first time he ever said that publicly on air.
Following the blast, Prime Minister Hassan Diab was forced to step down in respect for the victims. Investigations into the blast are still pending. Same goes for talks on forming a new government. Although the majority of Lebanese factions agreed to name Saad Hariri as Prime Minister, it seems the year 2020 will end and the formation of a new government remains in limbo. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
U.S. police say they have found possible human remains near the site of a huge blast that tore through the city of Nashville, Tennessee, on Friday.
Just the tissues is what you believe, and you've got human tissue. in the remains, is what you believe.
We believe. Could be, but to be for certain, we have to examine it. And once we know for sure, and then we'll let everyone know. But we're investigating it.
Drake said the origin of the tissue remains unclear and that there were no confirmed fatalities. He added a possible motive for the blast was unknown. Three people suffered minor injuries after a parked motor home in downtown Nashville exploded at dawn. The blast came just moments after officers responded to reports of gunfire in the area and discovered a recreational vehicle. Police said the explosion appeared to be an intentional act. Connie Campbell is our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and he joins us now. Connie, welcome. So details are emerging regarding this incident. Yet motive, responsibility, still unknown.
Intentional act because of the way that it was carried out. Apparently, there was a warning before the explosion actually detonated, and it said that there is a bomb inside this van. Please leave the area. And then it began a 15-minute countdown. Now, according to some reports, there was a 15-minute countdown, which ended and then restarted for another 15 minutes before the van actually detonated. But again, what was at interest here is that there was a warning emanating from the van through some sort of loudspeaker, almost telling people, listen, this is going to happen whether you like it or not, and you need to just get away if you don't want to be caught up in the blast. And of course, it did actually detonate, and it did mess up much of, I believe it's either 2nd Street or 2nd Avenue in Nashville, Tennessee, destroying various areas around it. Now, the bomb detonated as the bomb squad was on its way to deactivate the bomb. Obviously, they didn't make it in time. But who was the suspect here? Again, it's unsure what the motive was, especially in the way that it was carried out, giving a warning before it actually detonated.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one, Colin. Any local reports indicating perhaps, you know, as to, we don't want to speculate, but indicating as to perhaps what kind of motive there was?
It's really uncertain. I mean, there's so many variables here. If you look at Nashville, Tennessee, why Nashville? I mean, there's so many other cities. If they wanted to make a political statement or conduct some type of terrorism or something like that, you would think it would be a city like New York. Or D.C., or Miami, or Los Angeles even, not really Nashville, Tennessee. And the way that it warned people, like I said before, why would you warn people and not only just warn them, but give them a 15-minute warning? Why even 15 minutes? And then if it was, according to how other people reported the incident, that it was 15 minutes and then another 15 minutes, equaling 30 minutes, what happened there? There are just so many questions right now as police try to put together this crime scene. They say they found the human remains, and then, of course, they're going to try to identify who those remains belong to. As far as any other deaths, it's really uncertain because, again, this was a very big blast. So a lot of the evidence, of course, is going to be destroyed in the immolation of this bomb and the detonation of this explosive. The motivation here is why it could be widespread. There just doesn't seem to be any tight correlation for something politically motivated. But of course, this could have been someone who was mentally unstable, and they could have used any reason under the sun to try to justify why they should have detonated a van in Nashville, Tennessee.
Indeed. Detectives have a job on their hands there. Colin, thank you very much indeed for that. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Now, a British think tank says China will overtake the United States as the world's biggest economy by 2028 after outperforming its rival during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Center for Economics and Business Research said in its annual report that the pandemic and its economic fallout have changed the rivalry in favor of China. The U.S. is the worst hit country by COVID-19 in terms of both deaths and infections. The UK-based consultancy group said China has skillfully managed the coronavirus pandemic with its strict early lockdown. It said Beijing bounced back quickly from the effects of COVID-19 and would grow by 5.7% a year from 2021 to 2025 before slowing down to 4.5% a year from 2026 to 2030. Author and columnist Aina Tengen says China is economically more strong to make up for its lost revenues from imports after the U.S. boycotted Chinese products.
Right now, with these tech wars, they're simply pushing China to be less reliant on the U.S., therefore buying less U.S. products. Who is that hurting? It's not hurting China. China will emerge from it with their own independent IP, and they will continue to produce. Yeah, unfortunately, the U.S., many of the firms there will start shedding employees, and these are high-paying employees, which are going to continue to go down. Donald Trump chose to politicize what is, in essence, a medical scientific issue. China, in essence, followed its scientists. It did. At the time, remember, we go back 9 months, people were complaining that China was taking draconian measures, and they were being criticized widely across the world for imposing this lockdown. But it turns out that this was really the only way to do it. Now, one of the big issues, which for some reason no one is willing to talk about, is tracing. Right now, if you're tracing in China, they do it automatically. You have, anytime you go into an establishment, even your home apartment base, you will be scanned.
Turning to other news now, the number of deaths from the coronavirus has surpassed 190,000 in Brazil as the fast-spreading disease continues to rage across the country. The Brazil Health Ministry reported nearly 500 fatalities and nearly 23,000 new cases on Saturday. Brazil has over 7.4 million infections. In Mexico, more than 9,600 people contracted the virus in the last 24 hours. It's also registered more than 665 new fatalities, pushing the overall death toll to nearly 122,000. Mexico has already started mass coronavirus vaccination, along with several other Latin American countries. In the United States, the number of fatalities has surpassed 330,000, while its total cases are nearing 19 million. The U.S. remains the world's worst-hit country by the pandemic. The post-Brexit deal between the UK and the European Union is reportedly designed to keep both sides as close as possible to each other's regulatory orbits. According to British media reports, a full copy of the document shows both sides agreed to allow rebalancing of the deal in the future. According to the reports, such modification is possible if there are significant divergences capable of impacting trade. Also, both sides have agreed to exempt natural disaster situations, including the coronavirus pandemic, from restrictions on subsidies to companies. The details are first to come out after the deal was agreed on Thursday. The European and British parliaments must vote on the agreement before it comes into effect next week. EU nations have indicated they will formally back the agreement.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking point that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. It will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Our news bulletin is over. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
For years, Gaza's medical system has been on the brink of collapse due to the Zionist regime's brutal siege. This is part of the permanent emergency born by Israeli regime's occupation, colonization, and apartheid, as the human rights group Al-Hab states in a new position paper on COVID-19 and Palestinians' rights to health. COVID-19 poses a disproportionate and substantial threat to a Palestinian society deliberately denied for decades the right to develop a functioning healthcare system, according to Al-Hab. This is a direct result of apartheid policies and practices imposed by Israeli regime's prolonged occupation, the Palestinian group adds. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is published under the heading Israeli regime makes COVID much worse for Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The health ministry in Gaza has recently announced that it had halted testing for COVID-19 after running out of supplies. The interruption in testing came as one-third of COVID-19 test results in Gaza were coming back positive, a very high rate that likely indicates that not enough testing is being done in the first place. Of those confirmed cases, 20% were serious or critical. More than 150 people in Gaza have died from the coronavirus so far. From the beginning, there were well-founded fears that the pandemic would do disproportionate harm in Gaza. With community transmission now seemingly out of control, those fears may soon become reality. The unlivable Gaza Strip is home to some 2 million people, more than 40% of them aged 14 years old or younger, two-thirds of them refugees confined to its 139 square miles. It is one of the most densely populated places in the world. It has also one of the highest unemployment rates on the planet, and more than half of its residents live in poverty. Like every other sector in Gaza, the healthcare system has deteriorated after more than 13 years of siege and repeated brutal Israeli regime military offensives. Gaza's medical centers were still reeling from an epidemic of catastrophic injuries caused by the Israeli regime's use of live fire against civilian protesters when the pandemic hit. Shortages of essential medical supplies, to say nothing of electricity and fuel to operate generators during power outages, are nothing new in Gaza. At the end of November, the health ministry in the territory reported that it had less than a one-month supply of nearly half of all essential medicines. It also had critical shortages of medical disposables. For years, Gaza's medical system has been on the brink of collapse due to the Zionist regime's brutal siege. This is part of the permanent emergency born by Israeli regime's occupation, colonization, and apartheid, as the human rights group Al-Haq states in a new position paper on COVID-19 and Palestinians' right to health. COVID-19 poses a disproportionate and substantial threat to a Palestinian society deliberately denied for decades the right to develop a functioning healthcare system, according to Al-Haq. This is a direct result of apartheid policies and practices imposed by Israeli regime's prolonged occupation, the Palestinian group adds. Gaza, under a severe economic blockade and exacerbated Israeli regime's closure since 2007, has been cut off from the West Bank, which has been divided up into enclaves with differing degrees of limited Palestinian self-rule. This fragmentation is a key strategy of the Zionist regime's apartheid, a 2017 study by the UN Economic and Social Commission found. Israeli regime's prolonged occupation, colonization, and apartheid have deprived the Palestinians of their means of subsistence, according to Al-Haq. Humanitarian aid, like the COVID testing kits provided by WHO, addresses gaps in basic services. But it does not remedy the persistent and pervasive violation of Palestinians' basic rights. Beyond Israeli regime's movement restrictions, the ongoing denial of Palestinian self-determination remains a major impediment to the full and progressive realization of Palestinians' economic, social, and cultural rights, including to health, Al-Haq states. Palestinians are denied access to clean water and adequate sanitation, while political prisoners held by the Israeli regime face overcrowded and unsanitary detention conditions, the rights group adds. The political and historic forces to which Palestinians have been subjected compound their susceptibility to COVID-19, according to Al-Haq. The Zionist regime, as the occupying power, is legally, not just morally, obliged to provide essential supplies to the civilians living under its rule. Like so many of its obligations, the Zionist regime flouts its legal duties as third states look on and do almost nothing. As COVID-19 compounds Palestinian oppression, international justice and accountability are needed now more than ever to bring an end to the Israeli regime impunity, Al-Haq states. The group is calling for a full, thorough, and comprehensive investigation by the International Criminal Court and for the implementation of recommendations of prior UN inquiries into the Israeli regime's violations of Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, the heads of the European Union's diplomatic missions in Ramallah and Al-Quds visited Gaza for the first time since 2016. This remarkably long absence belies their claim that Gaza remains a priority for the EU and its member states. Though it acknowledges the dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza, the EU's statement on the visit barely mentions the Israeli regime's responsibility for the situation and makes no mention at all of its obligations as the occupying power. Instead, EU representatives Steve Kahn, Van Berstroff issued a generic call that all duty bearers should act now and respect their obligations under international law. The EU boasts of its humanitarian funding for Gaza's suffering population, but it is precisely because of the EU's stubborn unwillingness to hold the Zionist regime directly accountable that the Palestinian doctors who briefed its diplomats face such unprecedented challenges.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Ministry.
Lebanon seems to have officially entered a black hole, as if its fall has become fate. Those who are pushing for a faster collapse are none other than those who stipulate removing Hezbollah from the entire political scene, or else behold the great collapse. The U.S.-led war against the Lebanese resistance, with deadlier tools than those utilized in Afghanistan 2001, Iraq 2003, and Lebanon 2006, continues according to one main theory. Let the country collapse until we rebuild it without Hezbollah. A theory which Riyad Mohammed bin Salman completely supports despite the decline of his current position in the region's politics. However, he is always ready to interact whenever the opportunity arises, being the main financial guarantor for crafting disorder in the region. Until then, work will be resumed to complete the scattering of chaos in Lebanon through activating the dubious activities of NGOs, imposing new sanctions on Lebanese political figures, and pushing for instability in the country's national security, which makes the internal arena open to any possibility. What makes the current situation worrisome is that Israel today is present in every Arab country except the very few like Lebanon, meaning that the latter will not be allowed to deviate from this path and might be even forced to join the bandwagon of normalization. There is no longer any ambiguity that the corruption of the ruling elite and the absence of any serious effort to find a solution to the imminent collapse are helping the foreign powers push Lebanon towards this end goal. Economic observers view the country headed towards painful times in light of the downfall scenario that threatens all institutions which are no longer able to contain their dangerous repercussions. In parallel, Washington is activating its policy to destroy Lebanon in cooperation with local actors entrusted with the task, in addition to a set of basic pillars for its project run by the U.S. administration from abroad and the U.S. embassy in Beirut. The fruits of this chaotic labor have begun to appear at the level of both top health positions in public institutions and entry-level ones in everyday-born multi-million-dollar NGOs in the country. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. In the light of the Arab-Israeli normalization, pressure is increasing on Lebanon to join the bandwagon. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is currently playing the role of a spectator while the United States is working on its plan to implement a theory shared by Washington and Riyadh. Let the country collapse so that we rebuild it without Hezbollah. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mataz Al-Wahwah, political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Mataz, now it seems that work is resumed to maybe complete the sowing of chaos across Lebanon through activating NGOs, which usually they have Western-backed agendas and they are funded by also foreign powers by imposing maybe new sanctions on new political figures in Lebanon. And there's also this sense of loss of security in the country, which makes the internal scene just open to any sort of bad possibilities here. What is the worst case scenario for this country, in your opinion?
Well, absolutely. The worst case scenario at the moment would be absolute chaos. And this is something that the United States and Saudi Arabia have been extremely striving towards after all else has failed. We saw with the end of 2019 a movement on the streets, what was called the Cedar Revolution. We saw all these NGOs coming in, American NGOs, British NGOs, French NGOs, and what the common denominator between all of these NGOs was chaos. We saw no agenda, we saw no political structure, we saw no formation, we saw no organization. It was very evident that these NGOs and those that are behind them were striving to cause chaos on the streets and instability in order to pressure Lebanon and the powers that be in Lebanon to eliminate Hezbollah from the political equation here. And we saw a lull right after the U.S. elections. I think that's due to the U.S.'s allies here in Lebanon not being too certain on how things were going to go after Trump left the White House. But now it seems that Trump is trying to make up for lost time. We've got until January, the 20th of January, before he needs to leave the White House. And I think he's trying to invest everything he can, cause as much chaos in Lebanon and in the region, not just in Lebanon, but in Lebanon specifically, before he leaves office, so that he can make things extremely difficult for the next administration to come in and try and form any sort of political solution in the country.
Well, Mr. Marquez, a year ago, the main target of the, if you will, the protests or the revolution, whatever they want to put a name on it, was to expose the corrupt political class in Lebanon, and everyone is actually on board this. But now it is time maybe to drop them all. This is what the United States of America wants, regardless of the non-existence of any alternative option here. So the difference between then, between October 2019 and now December 2020, is that there were no Abraham Accords, meaning there were no Israel and Bahrain, no Israel and UAE, no Israel and Sudan and Morocco. And now it seems that they are pushing, and I'm saying that the United States of America, Israel, and other allies of Israel in the region, pushing Lebanon to normalize ties with Israel and maybe force them to normalize in order for the country not to go into deep black hole here. Do you think that's actually possible given the situation?
Well, I think the United States needs to understand that that's not its call. Yeah, one would need to be a fool to assume that the United States cares about corruption in Lebanon and is after combating corruption in Lebanon and getting rid of the corrupt figures that we have here. Most, if not all, of those who are involved in the corruption in Lebanon are the United States, its allies. It is very evident that the U.S., and this isn't just new, this is for the last 50 years, 40 years at the very least, the United States' main objective in Lebanon and the region is to have all Arab nations normalize ties with the Zionist entity. There is no other agenda here. In order for them to continue, in order for the United States to continue along with its mission in the Middle East, in order for it to secure its assets and to secure its needs here in the Middle East, it needs to have everybody on board. And the greatest thorn in the side of the United States at the moment is the axis of resistance. And especially if we're talking about Arab nations, if we're talking about Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq today, leaving the Islamic Republic aside, these three nations right now are the only Arab nations, apart from, let's say, Algeria and whatnot, are the only Arab nations on the forefront that have not and will not normalize ties with the Zionist regime. The United States tried a few months ago by pushing for indirect negotiations regarding our maritime borders here in Lebanon.
We all knew that's not going to go to the end.
And it did not. Mm-hmm. And it's very evident that now the United States and Trump is trying to create an atmosphere in the region where Lebanon feels isolated. He wants to say, look, all your neighbors have normalized. But the question here is that these neighbors of ours in the Middle East, they normalized 40, 50 years ago.
They wouldn't, it's me saying this. Yeah. I'm just, this is Marwa saying this. They wouldn't even exist as Arab states had they not been normalizing from day one. They wouldn't even have what they call, it's a fake independence, if you will. The British Army would not even have left had they not accepted to be normalizing with Israel since the early 70s, late 60s. But the U.S. might be maybe trying to strike the basic security in Lebanon right now. This is what is worrisome for the Lebanese public, especially by emerging sleeper cells. and may be fabricating sedition between the different political parties in Lebanon. This is no longer a secret, by the way, as many political and security forces are talking openly about bad security situation and the existence of serious threats against Lebanon. That puts a lot of question mark on the August 4th explosion of Beirut. It was the most powerful non-nuclear explosion on the planet. What do you think the country will face in the event of something, God forbid, similar happens again?
Okay, if I may, just touching on your last point very quickly and then continue on to the next one. Just, we need to remember that when it comes to normalization in Lebanon, the United States and allies tried in the 1980s. We had a president
who had an agreement,
and we had a president who was willing to normalize. The nature of the Lebanese people caused the Lebanese people themselves to forcefully remove their president. Mm-hmm. Naturally, the Lebanese people reject normalization. Mm-hmm. As for the issue of chaos and the current security situation in Lebanon, yes, for the past month or so, there has been excessive talk in the security circles about sleeper cells, about those willing to sow discord. We've even seen this slip on the lips of certain political figures in Lebanon. A few months ago, if you recall, it was no secret that Samir Jaja himself was speaking of 14,000 or 30,000 or 50,000 militiamen that he has willing to take to the streets. This is a scenario that is very serious, that the security apparatus is studying very well. But I think, and again, and this is a habit of the United States, they don't assess the situation very well in the Middle East. In Lebanon, assuming that we were to have absolute chaos, there is only one organization that would come up winning in this chaos.
And that's the only organization that's actually refusing to even get involved.
Absolutely.
Because they don't want any blood. I have less than 1 minute, but I need to ask this. The U.S. keeps saying we need to make Lebanon collapse and then rebuild it without Hezbollah. We're talking about more than 1.5 million Lebanese who give allegiance, not only support, to Hezbollah. What are they planning on doing with all of us?
Oh, they'd have to ship us all off to some desert somewhere, wouldn't they? I mean, it's absolutely irrational. Even President Macron of France, when he came right after the Beirut explosion, he came over here and he recognized and he said to the political parties, there is no Lebanon without Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the people here. Hezbollah is your farmers. It is your businessmen. It is the masses. Hezbollah is not a political movement made up of certain families. No, Hezbollah is the masses. It spreads all over Lebanon. And like you said, over 1.5 million, so more than half of the Lebanese population, is Hezbollah. You can't make Lebanon, you can't build a future Lebanon without Hezbollah, without the people of Hezbollah. This is absolutely irrational thinking.
And mind you, I'm saying 1.5, that's only the actual Shias who are
right.
giving allegiance to Hezbollah. I'm not even talking about the allies, the Christian, the Druze, the Sunnis, the allies of the resistance. I want to thank you very much. This was very interesting to talk to you, Mataz Al-Wahwah, political commentator with us from Beirut, to discuss the upcoming scenarios in Beirut. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
After a hard labor that lasted for more than a year, former Yemeni President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, who is hiding in Saudi Arabia, announced the birth of a new government that brings his supporters together with the members of the Transitional Council in accordance with the Riyadh Agreement. Hadi's announcement was met with restraint inside Yemeni circles, while Ansarullah considered this move merely an attempt to gather those dispersed outside Yemen and that it would soon prove its failure. The Riyadh Agreement, from which the new government seeks to take its legitimacy, has failed so far to establish a framework for understanding between the mercenaries of the aggression against Yemen in its two parts, the Saudi and Emirati. And till this day, it has been nothing but a tool to legitimize the colonial presence of the member of the coalition aggression in the southern and eastern governorates of Yemen. The Riyadh Agreement is the same illegitimate pact that the aggression countries used as a pretext for military intervention in the city of Aden, where Riyadh transferred thousands of Saudi soldiers there and established militias loyal to it in the governorates of Aden and Abyan and worked to control the governorate of Mahra. In the meantime, Hadi's illicit government faces many challenges, most notably the collapse of the national currency and the existing conflict between the countries of aggression, which was clearly reflected in the condition of their mercenaries on the ground and the conflict of sharing quotas between the parties of Hadi's government. And last but not least, the main challenge for Hadi is the achievements that the Yemeni army and the popular committees continue to attain, especially in the northern governorates, where they managed to liberate most of the land, and now they are close to controlling Ma'rib city, the last stronghold of the Hadi government in the north. Meanwhile, in a new achievement, the Yemeni Ministry of Interior announced last week the entry of armored vehicle Ba'S-1 to military service, noting that it is a 100% local production. The ministry confirmed that it was designed with high quality to work in various security operations.
Now with us to discuss this issue from Copenhagen is Mr. Roon Ayahuz. Thank you very much for being with us. Mr. Roon, you are a member of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Now, it is not even a matter of discussion, at least for me, that the last move by Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi had nothing to do with him, but rather it's just another political stunt by Saudi Arabia, maybe to savior or attempt to savior what can be saved yet from Yemen after their big failure, especially in the northern part of Yemen. I mean, the logic question here is, how will Hadi, or how does Hadi think that he will be running the show in the Yemeni government, or his prime minister for that matter, with the entire government is outside of Yemen?
Well, Marwa, it's frankly, in a lack of a better word, impossible for any exiled government to enforce its not only its authority, but also its jurisdictions in supposedly its own country, when without a manpower that is loyal enough to enforce the laws, rules, and procedures of the Hadi government. It is also worth to point out that the only thing that really secures the Hadi regime's presence in Yemen consists of mercenary groups terrorist groups such as the Al Qaeda and Daesh. So that's one thing. And secondly, when this new government was announced by the prime minister of Yemen of the Hadi regime on Twitter and social media, he published an infographic containing the names and the pictures of the new appointed ministers. However, point six in this list contains ministers appointed by the advice of the Saudi embassy, which means, frankly, that the Saudis have had a hand in handpicking certain members of this new, quote-unquote, legitimate government. So this is yet another example of how the Saudi regime breaches Yemeni sovereignty, contradicting all international laws and regulations.
Well, Hun, the government consists of 24 portfolios, as the Prime Minister said, supposedly divided equally between the North and the South, as stipulated in the so-called Riyadh Agreement. Yet still there is no mild attempt to even open a channel of dialogue with the rest of the country, and I'm speaking here about Ansarullah, the majority of the people who support Ansarullah here, they are excluded from the inclusive government, if you will. In light of all the achievements by the Yemeni armed forces and by the national committees of Ansarullah and the grave losses of the coalition forces, what is Mohammed bin Salman seriously waiting for just to put an end for this needless and unnecessary war?
Well, as I think has been quite evident, at least the past few years, the Saudi regime has already lost this war. They are merely trying to take its time to save face and to keep up this illusion that the Saudi regime, with its puppet government, so-called legitimate government of Mansour Hadi, this illusion that they are working in the best interest of Yemen, that is absolutely false. One has to point out, and one has to also remember, quite frankly, that the Hadi regime, when he was president during the transitional period, and his cabinet resigned in early 2015. So already there, he has no authority, no jurisdiction, no parliamentary mandate to enforce his own laws as he sees fit. I mean, it's the entire thing is one huge illusion. And if the Saudis, if they decide, okay, we have lost, admittedly, and now we are going to enter peace talks, as has been required by us, by all international parties involved in this conflict, then they would lose this, how do you say, this rock-solid firm stance towards, as they supposedly claim themselves, towards Iran, which is their main strategy. So they are not only trying to save face, but also trying to see what happens. How does this war turn out, and is it in our favor? They think, well, we'll just stick with it. It's a mess.
Well, many challenges really face this newly appointed Hadi government, like, for example, maybe improving the living conditions inside of Yemen while they are outside of Yemen. That's one. You have someone should stop the collapse and deterioration of the currency as well, which is obviously impossible without lifting the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia on the country. But another challenge is stopping the advancement of the Yemeni army and the popular committees towards what remains of the occupied Yemeni areas. I mean, Saudi Arabia and the coalition failed in achieving the last challenge so far. What do you think will change when Ansarullah just fully takes the Ma'rib city, which is, I think, it's days away from doing so?
Yeah, well, currently there are many factors which make Ma'rib strategically important. One is that the city and government bearing the same name is part of the so-called Eastern Oil Triangle, which it consists of Al-Baydar, Shabwa, Ma'rib, and Al-Jawf. And the Eastern Oil Triangle is really where most of Yemen's oil reserves are located. Another key factor also is the location of Ma'rib. It's sort of a checkpoint gateway between the populated or the populous west and the barren, lesser populated but rich east, with the vast desert regions, and also paves the way for the liberation or future liberation of Hadramaut and more.
Briefly, we are hearing a lot in the Western mainstream media that when Joe Biden, president-elect of the United States of America, Joe Biden, takes the White House, he will end U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. What's your take on that, knowing that even if he actually does, this does not mean stopping the war? If you stop sending weapons to Saudi Arabia, it doesn't mean that the war will actually stop. I mean, how do you feel about this? Do you think that actually Biden would be able to maybe correct the wrongdoings of Trump, or is it just a train that will keep on moving?
Well, I have my doubts huge skepticism of Biden's promise to end the war, considering the fact that Biden was part of the Obama-Biden administration that initially in 2015 pledged its support for the Saudi genocide of Yemeni civilians, still continuing to this day. I am sure he was briefed at the time about the consequences of this war, and I'm sure he's been briefed also during his transitional period about the war as well. I think personally, a military pullout of Yemen, it does not solve all problems overnight. I think one thing is the United States and the Western powers need to realize the facts and separate fact from fiction, that the fact is that a government, the National Salvation Government, is in control of 85% of the Yemeni people, and has been so for the past half a decade. It has direct authority of the Yemeni people, and certainly it acts and functions as a competent government with competent leadership. If the war is truly to come to an end, I think the Western powers and the international community has to at least recognize the demands of the Yemeni majority, counting for 85% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
But a shallow promises, as always, as all American presidential candidates bring about on the table during their campaigns, I'm very skeptical that
Thank you very much, Mr. Hoon Ayah, who is member of the Yemen Solidarity Council, for joining us from Copenhagen. You gave great insight into what's going on actually inside of Yemen and also inside the exiled government of Abdrabbo Mansour Hadi. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.